So we've just finished the first of the two main practices in the second point. So that's the wisdom practice, the ultimate bodhicitta practice. And so now we're going to look at the second of the two main practices, the conventional awakening mind or conventional bodhicitta. And so that is on the middle of page 93 in the commentary. So to introduce this section in the commentary, there's a number of quotes here from great Indian master Shantideva. So remember, Shantideva was one of the lineage masters that passed down this practice of exchanging self with others. So here it says, second, the conventional awakening mind of exchanging self and others is presented. This has been taught by Shantideva. So here are three quotes from Shantideva, who lived around the 8th century. His classic text, the Bodhisattva Charya Avatara, or the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. So the three sections in, I think they're all coming from chapter 8 of that text. He says, he who wishes to quickly rescue both himself and others should practice the secret instruction, the exchanging of self and others. So here it's called the secret instruction. So remember, of the two main methods for cultivating bodhicitta, this method of exchanging self with others was considered too difficult for the average person. So hence, it wasn't really taught publicly, and it was just taught secretively to those people who could really implement this approach. So the approach that was practiced most widely and taught most widely was called the seven cause and effect method. And those of you who have studied the Lam Rim stages of the path probably know these seven stages quite well. But what I'd like to do is just to briefly mention them here so that we are a little bit familiar with this technique before we go into the exchanging self with others practice. Now, even though this was the main technique that was taught historically, sometimes nowadays people have a little bit of a difficulty trying to use this technique. And one of the reasons is that this technique assumes a belief in rebirth. And if we don't have that belief in rebirth, then the very first step of this technique is a little bit problematic. And the very first step is to see everyone as our mother. And the reasoning behind this is that, of course, in this life we've got a mother, and then in the previous life we had a mother, and we keep going back. And using this line of reasoning, we can understand that everyone has been our mother at one time or another. And so in that way, we can see everyone as our mother. The idea being, behind this step, is that, historically at least, the mother has been the person that has benefited us most in our life. They carried us in the womb, they fed us when we were a baby, they looked after us, they clothed us. They really did benefit us so widely in our life. But unfortunately, in our modern society, many people have issues with their mother. So if we start seeing everyone as our mother, we may start hating everyone. So then the texts often say, well, if we have some problems with your mother, then substitute here father or brother, sister, uncle, teacher. Pick someone who has really benefited you most in your life, and then you can see everyone in that way. So again, the idea being here is to get a sense of closeness to everyone. To support that, the second step is to remember their kindness, is to really reflect on how our mother has been so kind to us in our life. And then from that, we would go to the third step of wishing to repay that kindness. And then based on that wish to repay their kindness, that would help us to develop both the fourth and the fifth step. Which is usually translated as great love and great compassion. So love or loving kindness here is defined as the wish for ourselves and others to be happy, whereas compassion is the wish for ourselves and others to be free of suffering. But great love or loving kindness and great compassion is a little bit more than just wishing ourselves and others to be happy and free of suffering. The word great here means that we are actively trying to provide ourselves, and particularly others in this case, all mother sentient beings, we're actively trying to provide them with happiness and trying to help them as much as possible to be free of suffering. So it's a little bit more than just having that aspiration or wish for them to be free of suffering and to have happiness. We're trying to do as much as we can to alleviate the sufferings of mother sentient beings and trying to help them place them in happiness. And then on that basis, then we can develop the sixth step. Which is the altruistic intention, which is not only trying to help them overcome suffering and help them to be happy, but to make it our personal responsibility to liberate all mother sentient beings from samsara. This is the altruistic intention. So that's building on these two. But then, of course, if we're at this step here, we can understand that in our current state, we're not much use to mother sentient beings. We can't help them very well. How can we be really of help to mother sentient beings? Is if we fully purify our mind, if we fully develop all of our positive qualities. In other words, if we become fully enlightened. So then from this, we would develop the aspiration for enlightenment so that we can really help liberate everyone from suffering. So this is bodhicitta, of course. So this is the seven cause and effect method that was most widely taught in terms of how to really cultivate this bodhicitta. So I just wanted to briefly mention that here so that everyone is aware of that. But here in the Lojong practice, we're going to be using the second technique, the technique of exchanging self with others. So that's what I'd like to look at now in some detail, and particularly also, of course, following the text on how to practice this. Before I go into that, is there any questions about any of these steps that's not clear?
So number 3 is like aspiring bodhicitta, and 4, 5 is
meditation. No, because remember, bodhicitta has two aspirations. The aspiration for enlightenment and the aspiration to benefit others. So here, we don't have the aspiration for enlightenment yet. It's only when we get down here that we understand that if we really want to help others, we have to get enlightened. So the aspiration for enlightenment comes as a result of this step. So previously, of course, here, we are starting to develop our love and compassion by wishing to repay their kindness. So this is the basis for really wishing mother sentient beings to be happy, wishing them to be free of suffering. And then, of course, through remembering their kindness, we can take that to the step of great love and great compassion, which is not just wishing them to be free of suffering, wishing them to be happy, but doing as much as we can to help mother sentient beings be free of suffering and to help them to be happy. On that basis, we can take that to another level of not only doing this, but making it our personal responsibility. I myself alone will liberate all mother sentient beings from samsara. So that's building on these two. Once we have developed that intention, then of course we can see that, well, actually in my current state I can't really do much to liberate mother sentient beings from samsara. How can I be most effective in doing this is by aspiring for enlightenment. So this is the bodhicitta. Is the aspiration for enlightenment so that we can effectively do this.
On point one, is it hypothetical, theoretical, or is it really saying, I guess I get hung up on the mathematics of that one.
Yeah. I think we don't really need to sort of do our head in, because mathematics here, we're talking about infinite sentient beings, and then we start talking infinite, our head sort of explodes. I think we can keep it very simple, understanding that we have a connection with every sentient being, and in that sense, we can use it like that.
In the book, they've tried to justify point 6 by saying that there have been more incidents of others helping us through various births compared to lesser harms done to us.
In that book?
In the book.
Yeah.
So we should make it our personal responsibility to liberate others. But how do you justify it?
Yeah. So, and this is going to be one of the strengths of the Lojong, it's coming in the next section, is, yes, of course, you know, the fact that we've even got clothes on our body is through the kindness of others. Did they have the intention to benefit us? Doesn't matter. We've benefited from them. Maybe they just had the intention to make lots of money. But still, indirectly, we've received a lot of benefit from others through their actions. Whether or not they intentionally wanted to help us, we have received a lot of benefit. I mean, if we really think about it, we could not survive in this world except for that, for the kindness of others in that way. So we shouldn't just think that others are kind to us in terms of the ones who are really trying to help us, but if we look at the interconnectedness of everything, you know, we can say that virtually everyone on this planet, directly or indirectly, has done something that resulted in us receiving benefit. So that's one point we can think about. And secondly, of course, as we're going to see in this text, is actually some of the people who have been most kind to us are the ones that irritate us or verbally abuse us. Why are they being kind? How are they being kind to us? Is that without these people, we would not be able to develop the quality of patience. Because if everyone's nice to us, how are we going to develop patience? Not easy. So therefore, even particularly the so-called enemy, which we're going to look at in this text, actually have been very kind to us because they help us to develop these qualities of patience. They also help us to see where we're at. Because, again, if everyone is super kind to us, we may get into this illusion that, oh, I never get angry. I've got rid of my anger. You know? I don't get angry anymore. It's only when people test us that we see, have we really got rid of anger or not? So actually these people also test us and see how much mental afflictions we still need to work on. So they're very helpful for us in the spiritual path in that way as well. So in that way, we can see particularly these people who we call the enemy actually are being very kind to us in that sense. So in whatever sense, then they're being kind to us. So that is one of the strengths of the Lojong system, is in the third section, is to be able to take these adverse conditions into the spiritual path. Of course, what we need to be careful of, and that's going to be highlighted, is that if someone is trying to verbally attack us, they're being kind to us in terms of helping us to develop patience. That doesn't mean that we continue to allow them to do that. Because then actually we're not helping them, are we? Because we're encouraging them to behave badly. So they can be kind to us because they can help us to not react with anger and to develop our patience, but they're also kind to us because they can help us to develop our compassion of trying to help them to overcome that negative behavior. So in that way as well. So that's something very important. Otherwise, often people take this in the wrong way and they end up being the doormat and people stepping all over them, and people taking advantage of us. So in that way, we're not being kind to them because we're actually sort of encouraging them to behave badly. So that's how, but again, a lot of this is coming in the text. So I just wanted to briefly mention that.
I've not seen Buddhists doing a lot of community service as compared to, say, the Christian community. They do an immense amount of charity, orphanages, this and that, but there's a lot of talk about it in the Buddhist texts. But the Buddhist community, in terms of where the religion is the fulcrum, they don't seem to do it. Why is it so?
That is a fault. And in fact, often the Dalai Lama criticizes the Buddhists for that, exactly that. He said, you Buddhists should be more like our Christian brothers and sisters and help society. So he's also very critical of people. And so I think, again, if we're really trying to develop love and compassion and we have the opportunity to help and we don't help, then we're not really being generous. Then we're just sort of lip service, love and compassion for everyone. But equally well, what we need to be careful of, or what do we need? How can we help others? You know, how can we help others? Is that if we, you know, one thing we should not do is enforce things onto people. So unfortunately, some people who try to help others do a little bit like that. So, you know, trying to force our own values onto others, of course, is not really helping them. So that's what we don't want to do. And of course, if we want to effectively help others, we need to look in terms of short-term benefit and long-term benefit. So of course it's great to go out and, you know, if there's starving people, give them food. We need to do that. But if that's all we do, then next week they're going to be starving again. We need to have a long-term strategy as well. And part of that long-term strategy, of course, is not only to help people to look after themselves, but to help people to develop their inner qualities. So if we really want to effectively help people, we need both those long-term and short-term strategies. So within Buddhism, of course, then there is quite a lot of emphasis on that long-term strategy as well, because if we're only looking short-term, then the problems are going to continue to perpetuate, particularly if people have a lot of anger and jealousy and hatred. If we don't address these things, then whatever short-term benefit we give is not really going to translate into long-term benefit. So we need to have both approaches. And so, therefore, here, in order to be able to really benefit others, we need to also look at long-term benefit. And for, to be able to do that, we need to really develop ourselves as a person. So we need to have a little bit that balance. But again, if we're not doing anything in society to help others, I think then we're not really being very genuine here. And as I said, often His Holiness Dalai Lama is quite critical of Buddhists who don't do that. You know, then they're really just pretending, you know, and they're not really cherishing others. So this is a very valid point.
Also, like we say, we need to have aspiration for bodhicitta to get enlightened ourselves and then help others. Do we have to wait till we get enlightened to help others?
No, exactly. That's the point. That's the point.
So what I'm saying
is that we... But the same, so the question, the analogy there is, let's say we want to go out and heal the world. I mean, we can go out straight away and put lots of bandages on people, or we could go away for 7 years to medical school to become a doctor and then go out to help the world. Which one would be more effective? I mean, if we have the ability to be a doctor, yes. If we're not, then of course that's not going to work for us. So therefore, but then we can sort of be critical of the person who's becoming a doctor. Well, for 6 years, you're not helping really anyone. So that, you're not being of any help. And that's why people sometimes criticize people who meditate, you know, go on a 3-year retreat. You know, you're just escaping from society. You're not being any benefit. But equally well, we could say to the medical student, you're escaping from the society. You're not benefiting anyone. You need to go out and put bandages on people's arms now. So again, we need to, you know, have that balance.
I probably see that that's why there's a reason that we don't see many Buddhist organizations doing things like other organizations are doing, because this has come from a very different perspective, hasn't been institutionalized in political way and hasn't been spread in that way.
Yeah. I mean, fortunately, you know, what I see is like centers in the West. When I see Buddhist centers in the West that are fairly large, have got some organization, if I don't see them doing some social work, social related work, it doesn't feel good to me, you know, because then they sort of like their own little group there. Whereas if I see a center that has enough infrastructure and I see that they're, you know, offering things to homeless people or they're trying to provide some community service in some way, then I find that's a very good thing to do. And I think this is what we also need to do, you know. This is very important.
And moreover, I believe educating...
But, oh, the other point I wanted to mention there is, again, we need to be careful that we don't just go into society and we say, we know best, you have to do this. This, I think, is not appropriate. Yeah.
And well, I believe the Buddhist teachings are more based on an educational way, knowledge based, rather than being giving based, you know, giving away based. So,
not spread that much. Well, see, there's in the Lam Rim teachings when it talks about particularly, you know, as a teacher, how should you benefit others? You know, it normally says there are sort of 4 steps to that. The first is to offer material things, immediate help. You know, the second is then to communicate in a nice, good way with the person, to have some connection to the person. The third thing then is to give some advice and guidance on how they could improve their lives. But the fourth thing is, if you want to do that, you need to lead by example. You need to be doing these things. Otherwise, it's just a show. So this, I think, is very important. You know, I think it's a bit hypocritical for us to sort of tell people to do something that we're not doing ourselves. You know,
it's not effective
anymore. No, it's not effective because people can see through that you are not being genuine because you're not actually trying to do what you're telling them is good for them. So this is, so these are usually the 4 things that are mentioned in terms of how we benefit others, is that we need to lead by example.
Empathetic joy, we say, so they won't be apart from there is the happiness of temporary happiness and genuine, right? But if someone is laughing at someone who just slipped from, you know, down the stairs or something, or a banana or something, and you start laughing, you have empathetic joy for that person, but that is not itself.
No, that's not empathetic joy.
So that's it. How do you know?
Yeah. Sorry?
You see someone who is laughing.
Sure.
Who is, at that moment, his state of mind is uplifted. But the cause for that...
Yeah, okay. So again, it's, I mean, in those situations, of course, it's difficult to know what's going on in the person's mind. But we can just try to evaluate as best we can whether it's a result of doing something good or harmful. So that's all we can do. We don't know. I mean, we don't know what's going on in the person's mind. But we're not rejoicing in people who are happy about being cruel to others. That's not empathetic joy. Right, let's move on to the exchanging self with others technique. There's two more quotes here from Shantideva. It says, if you do not thoroughly exchange your own happiness with others' suffering, you will not become a Buddha. And here's actually a typo in the next line. Even in samsara, there will be no happiness. I actually checked the Tibetan text and there is a no in there, so they forgot to put it in. But anyway, how do you say the third word in the next one?
Assuage.
Assuage. Hence to assuage, sounds very strange. Hence to assuage your own injuries and to pacify others' sufferings, you should give your own self to others and protect others as you would yourself. So these are three quotes from Shantideva's classic text, which are talking about this exchanging self with others approach, this technique that we're now going to look at in some detail in this text. So what I'd like to do is to first briefly present the entire process. And here in this Lojong text, the technique is simply called exchanging self with others. But the full technique is often called equalizing and exchanging self with others. And in the full technique, there are five steps. The first step is to equalize self with others. So self here, of course, simply just means me. It's not referring to this Atman. It just means equalizing ourself with others. And the reasoning here is a little bit like in the mind of equanimity, in that we can understand that our happiness is no more important than the happiness of anyone else. We're all equal in wanting to be happy and wanting to be free of suffering. So that's what equalizing self with others means, to put ourselves on the same level as everyone else in terms of wanting to be happy, wanting to be free of suffering. Then the next two steps sort of go together. is that reflecting on the disadvantages of self-cherishing. So remember, this self-cherishing mind is this mind that sees my happiness as the most important thing on the planet, more important than the happiness of anyone else. And this self-cherishing is coming from self-grasping. Is with the self-grasping mind, which is what we looked at just before, is we're grasping onto the belief there is an independent me here, this self, this independent me. Then, on the basis of seeing ourselves as an independent me, independent of the world, then often what follows is not only seeing ourselves as independent of the world, but the center of the world. Everything revolves around me. My happiness is the most important thing, more important than anyone else. So what we need to do here is to reflect on the disadvantages of this self-cherishing mind, because on the surface of it, it seems like self-cherishing is our best friend. That if we don't have this self-cherishing mind, we're going to lose out. We're not going to be happy. But actually, if we look at it closely, we'll see that the self-cherishing mind is our worst enemy. Because self-cherishing is this selfish, self-centered attitude that sees our happiness is more important than the happiness of anyone else. And as I mentioned a little bit earlier, if we have this strong self-cherishing attitude, which of course is based on the self-grasping, if we're sort of obsessed about me and my happiness and me and my suffering, then often we end up with a lot of fear and anxiety about the world, because everything out there seems to be a potential threat to me and my happiness, so I better be on guard. So it becomes very stressful life as well, because we always have to be on guard. We can never relax. In fact, there was recently a very extensive medical study done, I think it was either in the US or Europe, where the result of this medical study was that people who use the words I, me and mine a lot have a 35% greater risk of heart attack. So it seems like it's quite stressful, this me, me, me obsession. And then, of course, as I mentioned earlier as well, to protect ourselves from this potential threat that seems to be out there, we tend to build a big wall around ourselves to protect ourselves. But then, of course, by doing that, we feel very isolated and lonely. So this self-cherishing leads to a lot of loneliness as well. And then on the flip side, because we're obsessed about me and my happiness, and the happiness seems to be coming from out there, we end up with a lot of craving and attachment to things. Which means, of course, if we don't get those things that seem to be making us happy, then we get a lot of frustration. So often we have a lot of frustration in our life. And even if we get those things, they never really fully satisfy us, and we simply end up craving for more, 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 more. And then we often become very dissatisfied and a very unsatisfactory experience, because nothing seems to be really satisfying us. And then even we can become quite depressed because nothing is really bringing me happiness that I'm looking for. And so we can end up with a lot of depression from that. And then, of course, also with this self-cherishing mind, we have this exaggerated sense of self-importance. And as a result of that, then we often show a lack of consideration and respect for others. And then, of course, if we see people who seem to have more than us, we get very jealous. And then we also tend to get very competitive with others, trying to outdo them and put them down. And then if we happen to see someone who seems to be at a lower level than us, we often then become very arrogant and dismissive of them. And then, of course, if someone is standing in the way of our happiness, so we'll even go to the extent of harming others who stand in the way of our happiness. Of course, if we harm others in the pursuit of our happiness, generally they harm us back. But then, sort of in the back of our mind at least, we understand that harming others is not the right thing to do. So if we end up doing a lot of harming others in the pursuit of happiness, we often have a lot of guilt and maybe even some low self-esteem. We don't see ourselves as a very good person. And then, as I mentioned also the other day, if we have this self-cherishing mind, you know, and we tend to see every situation from a very narrow perspective. How is this situation affecting me and my happiness? Then on that basis, we categorize people into three groups depending on how they affect me and my happiness. To the people who seem to support me and my happiness, we label friend. Those people who don't seem to affect me and my happiness in any way, stranger. Those people who seem to interfere with me and my happiness and seem to even cause me some suffering, the so-called enemy. So we tend to categorize people into these three groups solely from the perspective of how they are affecting me and my happiness. Then, of course, to the group we labeled friends, we have a lot of attachment because they seem to be the source of our happiness. To the strangers, we often become very apathetic and indifferent because they don't seem to be affecting me in any way. And to the group we've labeled the so-called enemy because they seem to be interfering with me and my happiness, we have a lot of hostility, anger, and hatred towards them. So we have a lot of attachment to friends, apathy to strangers, hostility, anger, and hatred to difficult people. This is coming from the self-cherishing mind, which means that it becomes almost impossible to develop love and compassion for others in any genuine way. Because love and compassion for the strangers, oh, not really, I couldn't care less what happens to them because they're not affecting me. Love and compassion to the enemy, no way. In fact, I hope they suffer because they deserve to suffer because they're harming me. Love and compassion to the friends, okay, but only as long as you keep saying and doing things that make me happy. Otherwise, I'm not going to love and have loving kindness and compassion for you. So our love and compassion to our friends is polluted by attachment. So these are some of the disadvantages of the self-cherishing mind. And by reflecting on this, we'll begin to appreciate that this self-cherishing mind is not really our friend bringing us happiness. And unfortunately, our modern society is often promoting this idea that actually the self-cherishing mind is our best friend. You know, look after number one. If you don't, no one will. You're special. So this is the what is often unfortunately promoted in our modern society. But as by reflecting on this, we can see that actually our self-cherishing mind is our worst enemy. Together with that, it's helpful to reflect on the third point. And that is to reflect on the advantages of cherishing others. And the advantages of cherishing others are pretty well the opposite of the disadvantages of self-cherishing. Meaning that if we have the attitude of cherishing others, then we're not having this self-obsession, me and my happiness, me and my suffering. Which means that we won't have all this fear and anxiety and stress about all that potential threats out there. We won't need to build a big wall around ourselves We won't feel isolated and lonely. Because of cherishing others, we'll feel much more connected with everyone. And then, of course, we're not obsessed about me and my happiness. We won't have so much craving and frustration and disappointment as we do with the self-cherishing mind. Also, of course, we will not have an exaggerated sense of self-importance, which means that we will be showing consideration and respect for others. And if someone seems to have more than us, instead of becoming jealous, we'll be happy for them. And we won't be competitive with others, trying to outdo them and put them down. We'll be trying to help others. And if someone seems to be at a lower level than us, instead of becoming arrogant, dismissive, we'll be trying to help them. And of course, then we won't be deliberately harming others in the pursuit of our happiness. We'll be trying to help others. And because of this mind of cherishing others, then when we go into a situation, we won't be having this very narrow perspective of simply, how is this situation affecting me and my happiness? We'll be looking at the hot situation from the perspective of everyone. So therefore, instead of having attachment to friends, apathy to strangers, hostility, anger and hatred towards the difficult people, will be developing loving kindness and compassion towards everyone. So if we reflect on the advantages of cherishing others together with this, then we're going to want to exchange self with others, exchange our self-cherishing attitude with the attitude of cherishing others. Now, one point here that is very important that I sort of already briefly mentioned, and to talk about it, I'll introduce a real life example, is some years ago in one of the courses here there was a Danish school teacher who was teaching primary school children, and then he heard about this idea of cherishing others. And he thought this was a fantastic idea. And so he wanted to really implement this with his school children when he went back to Denmark. And he tried to implement this, but what happened was that the children in his class went wild. They started misbehaving and doing all sorts of misbehaving in class. And then he had a real problem because he knew, or he really felt, that cherishing others was the right thing to do, but the result was a mess. But then slowly he understood that cherishing others doesn't just sit there, smile and say nice things, because that's what the children saw, and they saw that he wasn't disciplining them, so they just went crazy. So to cherish others is to help others. So if we're allowing others to misbehave, we're not cherishing others. So with cherishing others, we need to have wisdom. Otherwise, the result can be a mess. And the result can be that we end up being the doormat and people walk over the top of us. Then that's not cherishing others. Because actually we are sort of encouraging them to behave badly. So therefore, cherishing others, or compassion, or has to come with the wisdom. And so therefore, for that school teacher eventually understood, to cherish his children, he needed to help the children to improve their behavior. And so that if they were misbehaving, he would discipline them and encourage them to behave in a better way. Then things started to improve, of course. Well, originally I think he thought that cherishing others was just smile and say nice things.
I understand that in a lot of cases we usually don't know what is really good for others because we don't know the situation perfectly.
Exactly. Exactly.
But how can we behave until we know?
Well, that's why we need the cherishing others, the compassion, and we need the wisdom. That's why these are the two main aspects we need to develop. But the thing is here, when we're in a situation, we can't say just, oh, stop, give me 10 years to develop my wisdom and compassion, then I'll come back and do something. Can't do that. So what we have to do, of course, is using the best wisdom and compassion we have available to us, we have to respond. That's all we can do. And here, you know, sometimes people see that their motivation for helping others is a bit selfish. You know, they're doing something to help others, expecting or hoping to get something back. And then they go, okay, I'm not going to do it because there's a selfish motivation. If we do that, I think we'll never begin to do anything to help anyone. Because for us at our level, to do something without even a hint of selfishness, I think is virtually impossible. I mean, even the motivation of, you know, helping others, expecting that at least they'll say thank you. So rather we should here follow Dalai Lama's advice. He often says, you know, he understands that we're quite selfish, and that to be completely unselfish is going to be a long-term endeavor. And he says, okay, if you have to be selfish, at least be selfish in a smart way. Meaning now we are selfish in a dumb way, meaning we harm others in the pursuit of our happiness. This is selfishness in a dumb way. Selfishness in a smart way is understanding that my happiness is dependent on the people around me. So if I help them, they're more likely to support me and help me. So we can have a selfish motivation in that way. That's smart selfishness, rather than harming others who get in our way. And if we do that, that's a little bit easier to implement. So then we can do that. And then the more we do that, the more we will really come to appreciate that the joy that we get from merely helping others is far more than any joy of getting anything in return. So you'll find that your selfish motivation in helping others will slowly decrease over time. So that's where we need to start. So help others, and if we notice there's some selfish motivation, notice that and try to reduce that as much as possible, but still help. Still work on helping others. Otherwise, if we get to the point we say, I'm not going to help others, if there's any selfish motivation, I think we're not going to be able to begin to do anything. So I think this is a practical approach for this. And of course, as you rightly said, now often we don't know, our wisdom is lacking, how to help them. But then we still need to try. And then, of course, if we do something and we see later it was a big mess, then we learn from that, and next time we do something different and improve. That's all we can do. That's all we can do. Okay. So, where were we? Oh, yes, advantages of cherishing others. Then, the fourth step. So, these are the sort of the preliminary steps. Then, as with the emptiness practice, we have, in the practice of exchanging self with others, the two core practices, the meditation practice and the daily life practice, which are step 4 and 5, which are the two things that we're going to look at in the text now. So the fourth step is exchanging self with others, which is what to do in daily life. Meaning, having reflected on these two things, then we'll have the motivation of wanting to exchange our current self-cherishing attitude for the attitude of cherishing others. So then, in our daily life activities, we then try to, as much as we can, exchange our self-cherishing motivation to replace that with the motivation of cherishing others. How to do that, of course, is coming up in the text. So this is the daily life. And then the meditation practice for this technique is called Tong Len. Tong Len is a Tibetan word which literally means giving and taking. So this is the meditation practice for exchanging self with others. And that is what we're going to look at now. So remember, like the ultimate bodhicitta, conventional bodhicitta, there are the two parts to the practice, the meditation practice and the subsequent period practice. So we're going to again first look at the meditation practice, and then we're going to look at the daily life practice, what to do here. So that's what's coming now in the text. So let's now begin to have a look at that. So we're on page 94 at the top. The meditation session. It says, how to practice during the meditation session is presented by the following. It says here, train in the two, giving and taking alternately. So this is the practice of Tong Len. So let's have a look at this practice and how it's described here, because this is going to be the practice that you'll be doing with Richard this evening. I think probably many of you have already done this Tong Len practice, but anyway, we'll go through the text here and see how to do it. So the commentary says, seated on a comfortable cushion, visualize your dear mother vividly in front. So as with developing loving kindness and compassion, here also with the Tong Len practice, it's recommended that we develop this in stages. So, again, as with cultivating loving kindness and compassion towards everyone, also with this Tong Len practice, we are to cultivate it in stages. That it's recommended that we first do this practice with friends, someone close to us, because it's most easy. Once we're comfortable doing this practice of exchanging self with others or people close to us, we can then move out to strangers. People we don't know very well. Once we're comfortable doing this practice with strangers, we can move out to the so-called enemy. Or the difficult people, or people we find difficult. And then we can extend it out to all sentient beings. And so generally in the text with Tong Len, also with the loving kindness compassion practice, it says to do it in these stages. Friend, stranger, enemy, and then all sentient beings. And this is how it's sort of presented a little bit here in the commentary. And we're going to go through that based on, it says here, to visualize your dear mother in front. So, again, you can have your mother, father, brother, sister, partner, someone close. And we're going to go through in this way. But what I'm going to also mention a little bit later is I think it's helpful, particularly in our modern society, where there seems to be an epidemic of low self-esteem, that we need to add one thing at the beginning here. Yourself. Because if we're not kind and compassionate to ourselves, if we don't feel good about ourselves, then we're not going to be able to do these practices. We're not going to be able to develop this love and compassion for others. So, therefore, if we are the sort of person that doesn't feel good about ourselves, we have low self-esteem, then as with the loving kindness and compassion practice, also the Tonglen practice, we can begin by doing it with ourselves.
Doesn't this give rise to more self-grasping and self-cherishing? I think, wow, yeah, be so happy about you, you're so amazing.
No, because we have to sort of understand what the practice is first. Yeah. So maybe we'll go through the practice and then we'll see how that relates to that. In fact, I think maybe with Richard in, because we're going to be doing this Tonglen practice a few times with Richard, and I think in at least in one of them he's going to do it with you yourself as the person. So, again, there's a big difference between feeling good about yourself, being kind and compassionate to yourself, and then self-cherishing. They're actually sort of opposite. But we're going to be looking at this more in detail. That's coming up in the discussions anyway. But anyway, let's look at this Tonglen practice based on the friend. Here it says to visualize your dear mother. But again, what can be useful here is to begin with someone who is sort of close to you, who's got actually some sort of problem at the moment, some sort of problem or suffering at the moment. But anyway, let's follow the commentary through. It says, first, to cultivate loving kindness and compassion, reflect in the following manner. Because she, my mother, first gave me the human existence of leisure and opportunity, which she nurtured without any negligence, I have encountered the Buddha's teachings. Because of this, today, it is possible to grab happiness by its very snout. She has thus helped me. Throughout all stages, when I was in her womb and after birth, she nurtured me with impossible acts of kindness. Not only that, since samsara's beginningless time, she has constantly watched over me with eyes of love, perpetually held me with affection, and repeatedly protected me from harm and misfortune. She has given me so much benefit and happiness, and has thus embodied true kindness. So, actually this is a little bit from the same idea as in the seven cause and effect, is to remember their kindness, to remember mother sentient beings' kindness. And then it goes on to say, reflect thus and cultivate a depth of emotion such that tears fall from your eyes and the hair of your paws stand on end. And then we can go on, it says, you should reflect. How sad that she, my kind mother, has been wandering in the infinite cycle of existence with so many kinds of sufferings, all the while working for my benefit. In return, I shall now help her by providing her benefits and happiness. I shall protect her from harm and all misfortune. You should reflect in this manner. So this here is really trying to develop loving kindness and compassion. And then it goes on, it says, what harms this dear mother? Suffering harms her directly, while the origin of suffering injures her indirectly. So again, the origin of suffering, of course, is mental afflictions, ignorance and mental afflictions. So while thinking, I shall take all of these upon myself, take into your own heart in clean swaths, as if layers sheared off by a sharp knife, all the sufferings, their origin, the afflictions, and the subtle defilements to knowledge along with their propensities, all of which exist in your dear mother. So here, it's talking about the whole spectrum of sufferings and obscurations that we have. So all the suffering, their origin, of course, is the ignorance. And then, of course, all the mental afflictions that come from ignorance. So this, that is the afflictive obscurations. And then here it says the subtle defilements to knowledge along with their propensities. So these are the subtle stains of ignorance. So this is the cognitive obscurations. So if we want to be very elaborate, then we can think about all these various levels of obscurations that our mother has. Not just the immediate direct suffering, but all the afflictive obscurations that lead to those, and then all the cognitive obscurations as well, these stains in the mind. And it says here, this is the meditation on the taking aspect of awakening mind. So here, what we are doing is we are imagining taking on this suffering of our mother. Now, I'll just jump forward a little bit because I want to explain the meditation clearly. If you go on to page 96, the next slogan there, it says, to place the two astride your breath. You should train in the two giving and taking in relation to respiratory exhalation and inhalation. This makes it easier to maintain your mental focus because the breath is readily available, and this method combats many false conceptualizations. So with this giving and taking, then, usually it's conjoined with the breath, because again, by focusing on the breath, it helps us to stay focused, and it's sort of a natural way to do this practice. So here, the taking aspect means to take on the suffering of our mother. We do that in conjunction with the breath, the in-breath. So what I'll do is I'll just briefly explain now how to do that, because this is what you're going to be doing with Richard this evening. And so here it talks about visualizing your mother in front of you. I'm not sure how Richard's going to begin. He may say that. He may begin by saying, just pick anyone close to you who's currently got some sort of suffering. Or he may even begin with ourself as the person. But let's just use the example of someone close to you who is currently having some sort of suffering or problem. You imagine them very clearly in front of you. Then you imagine this problem or suffering in the form of black smoke filling their body. And then, as it's mentioned here, is to develop this compassionate attitude of wishing to help take that suffering away from that person. And then what we do is, using the in-breath, we imagine drawing that black smoke of suffering out of their body. And as a beginner, we can do this using a number of breaths. So we can imagine using maybe 3, 4, 5 in-breaths, drawing that black smoke out of their body successively, and imagining that it comes across and forms a little cloud in front of your face. Then the next step here is to imagine your selfish, self-cherishing mind as a small, hard, black rock in the center of your chest, at the level of your heart. And then, using one in-breath, imagine drawing in that black smoke of suffering, that it comes down, it touches the black rock of self-cherishing, and then both are completely destroyed. Because it's our willingness to take on the suffering is destroying the self-cherishing mind. Because the last thing the self-cherishing mind would want to do would be to take on any suffering from anyone. So by wanting to take on that suffering so that they can be free of it, of course, is compassion. And then imagining it touches the black rock of self-cherishing and both are completely destroyed is symbolizing the fact that that compassionate mind, that wanting to take the suffering, is what's actually destroying our self-cherishing mind. So this is the first part of the practice. And then it goes on in the commentary, it says, again thinking, I shall myself seek the complete happiness of my dear mother, unconditionally offer your body, wealth, and all your virtues to your mother. This is the meaning of the following lines in the guide to the Bodhisattva's way of life. So again, this is the text from Shantideva. To accomplish the welfare of sentient beings, I shall turn my body into a wish-fulfilling jewel. And so again, here, if we look at what to do, it says, imagining, therefore, your body, wealth, and roots of virtue as precious wish-fulfilling jewels. From these emerge for your dear mother all the conditions for engaging in spiritual practice, such as food, clothing, shelter, assistance, as well as reliance on a spiritual teacher. All the conditions favorable to attain the attainment of enlightenment, whatever she wishes. Imagine because of this that your dear mother accomplishes the accumulation and attains Buddhahood. This is the meditation on the giving aspect of awakening mind. So here, again, what we're imagining is we're imagining giving away all of our wealth and happiness and virtues to our mother, to the person in front of us. So this, of course, is loving kindness. And this wishing to do this is what is smashing the self-cherishing mind. Because the last thing the self-cherishing mind would want to do would be to give away anything to anyone. So imagining doing that is really destroying our self-cherishing mind as well. And as it's said here, what we can do is we can imagine all of our positive qualities and everything we have as we can imagine it as a small white light in the center of our chest. And then we combine this part of the practice with the out-breath. So we imagine breathing out this white light. And like the first part, as we're learning this process, we can use a number of out-breaths to give away these things to the person in front of us. And as suggested here in the commentary, is that we can imagine this white light transforming into everything they need to be happy. And that can be very simple things like food and shelter and clothing, but it can also be transforming into all the conditions they need to flourish in the spiritual path. So it can be short-term things, long-term things. And imagine that it transforms into these things, this white light, as we're breathing out. And then at the end of that process, we imagine that that person has now achieved their goal and we can develop some happiness, some joy that they've now achieved that goal. So this is the giving aspect of this practice. So this is cultivating the loving kindness, giving happiness to the person in front of us. So there's a question. This is coming in the text. It's coming up very shortly. But I'll make a little comment on that now because actually it's not in the text, it's in this book here which I'm going to quote from. When this process is explained, then often people have some doubts. The first doubt is, if this person has some serious illness, and I imagine taking it on, I might get sick, I might get this illness, so I'm not going to do this. So remember, this is a mental exercise. So we can't actually take their illness from them. But then people say, well, if we can't take the illness from them, what's the point of this exercise? And the main point of this exercise, of course, is to transform our self-cherishing mind into the mind of cherishing others. So the main beneficiary of this meditative exercise is ourself. Because by doing this exercise, We are weakening and destroying the self-cherishing mind. We are weakening and destroying our attachment and aversion. And instead, we are strengthening our mind of cherishing others. We are strengthening and cultivating the mind of loving kindness and compassion. Which means, of course, that if we do this effectively, then outside of meditation, we're more likely to help this person in a more genuine way. Because now, if that person is close to us, we may help them, but sometimes we have sort of our own motivation for helping them. We know best. You need to do like this, because I know best. Rather, if we do this practice, we'll be helping this person in a more genuine way, with a less selfish motivation, more really for the benefit of their benefit. Also, of course, by doing this, it means that when we meet people who normally we really don't help, even though they've got a problem, because we really couldn't care less about them, by doing this, if we have the opportunity, we'll start to help them. And we will even try to help difficult people who now definitely we don't often help. In fact, we get upset at them because they're behaving badly. We attack them. So by doing this practice effectively, the main beneficiary is ourself, but then indirectly, of course, everyone else benefits. But also, directly, others can benefit. And this is also going back to the previous topic of emptiness, dependent arising, the interconnected nature of reality. Meaning that everything we do, even mentally, has an impact. And we know this in a simple way. Like when someone walks into the room who is radiating love and compassion, without them saying anything, they often have a very positive, direct impact on our mind. Likewise here, if we do this practice in a very genuine way, particularly if we're doing it with a person we have some connection with, then we can have a direct positive impact on their mind, even if they're on the other side of the planet. And I think there is some scientific evidence to support this. So we should not underestimate the power of the mind. So we can, at a subtle level, have this direct positive impact on them. But again, the main reason to do this practice is to transform our own mind so that in our daily life we can really benefit others in a more effective, beneficial way.
This sounds strange again, but how emotional should the whole thing get? Because we can look at suffering very abstract, very from mind, or especially if you really imagine
Sure. So again, we need to do it in stages. And so often what's also recommended is, even with the friend, don't pick as a beginner a friend who's got a very heavy problem. Because we're going to get emotional and overwhelmed. We're not going to be able to do this well. So maybe then, you know, maybe pick someone who's got a slight problem to begin with as a beginner. And then we need to work up to more difficult situations. So don't pick that as a beginning point. You know, maybe our friend has, you know, got a twisted ankle or a broken leg and got plaster or something, you know. Nothing too heavy to begin with.
I find language very heavy of the text. This is saying that all my mothers who have been in the samsara and cyclical and things like that. See, for me, the objective is just to be a loving child, a loving husband, and a loving father, and be reasonably good professionally. The objective is not to attain enlightenment or to attain Buddhahood or to be a great scholar. And when this entire language says, I offer my everything to you, my body, my wealth, and oh, my mother, you are in this cyclical existence, I find it too strong. I mean,
exactly, because our self-cherishing mind is very strong now. This language, our self-cherishing mind goes, oof, no, I'm not going to do that. So that's why we need to do it in stages.
I mean, I would much rather be half of this age than...
Exactly. So, as I said before, you know, to go from completely selfish to completely unselfish, we need to do it in steps. So that's why, as you rightly said, we can do this in stages, is we can, you know, start something simple, some small thing that we're going to work with, and then we can work up. And that's sort of a little bit what's it's going to come a little bit also in the text here. But this is just sort of laying out the sort of the big picture for the whole process. So yes, we can start with something small, and as our self-cherishing mind reduces and our mind of cherishing others increases, then we can sort of expand on this practice. Yes, absolutely.
The so-called enemy, sometimes in this practice, the light coming out is a bit harder probably because of self-grasping. So would you recommend to take like a minor enemy before taking...
Yeah. Yes. I mean, again, with these stages, is to do them. I mean, when we get here, don't pick your worst enemy. It's not going to work. Maybe start by picking someone who sometimes irritates you a little bit. You know, someone who you find a little bit uncomfortable. Start there. Slowly move out. Otherwise, like I said, if you pick something too big as a beginner, you'll get overwhelmed by attachment, aversion, and that's not going to help this practice.
So in the case of, for instance, a caregiver, if you're doing this practice and you're taking on the illness or you're taking on the suffering of others, and then you're just blowing it out and releasing it, is that right?
No, it's being symbolized as being the willingness to take it on is what is destroying self-cherishing. So we visualize that by the black smoke touching the rock and both are completely gone.
Right, but now without the self-cherishing, in the example of a caregiver, I mean, there are people who are caregiving, just say, cancer patients.
Right.
You know, and they've been known to take on so much energy or so much sympathy.
Right.
For the patient that they in turn
right.
become ill themselves.
Correct, because they are identifying with that and grasping onto it.
So
it's the same as everything. If we have, forget about other people, if we have anger or something coming up in our mind, if we grasp onto that and identify with it, we will suffer immensely. We don't need to talk about taking on anything from someone else. If we identify with our own negative stuff, we suffer immensely.
Right. But
so if
you're using this practice, you're taking some, but then you are letting it go yourself.
Well, that's why, to avoid identifying and grasping onto it, the visualization is the black smoke touching the rock of self-cherishing and completely vanishing. Another variation of this is, instead of using the black rock of self-cherishing, we can use this, what's called Buddha nature, the inner purity of our mind. So we can visualize that as a small white light, you know, our inner wisdom. And then we can imagine the black smoke being completely dissolved there, because it's our inner wisdom that is dissolving all suffering and its causes. So we can also do that. But either way, we're not identifying with that, because identifying with anything like that, whether it's from someone else or our own suffering, is just going to create suffering. So that's why it's important to make sure that that visualization is the right sort of visualization. Otherwise, we end up identifying with this stuff. And then, you know, if we identify with our anger, if we hold on to that or suppress it, we get a lot of physical sickness and illness, of course. So the same goes whether it's our own stuff or others' stuff, it's the same principle. This is something very important. Okay, I think that's a good place to stop. I mean, there's a lot more to say, but I think we can stop there. I want to, of course, go on to talk a lot more about some of these other aspects here tomorrow. So let's break there. And this evening you're going to start to do a very simple Tonglen meditation with Richard. So then you'll get a little bit of a taste of that. And then we can use that as the basis for continuing our discussions on this practice tomorrow morning.